And our guest, Dr. Mark Siegel, we're going to take your phone calls now when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Mark Siegel, our guest. Mark, what was it that created the false alarm, the truth about the epidemic of fear in your mind for you to go ahead and write the book?
That's the most important question of the night, George. That happened because I began to notice after 2001, September 11th, that people were afraid that were coming to see me, and they are afraid of the personal terrorists. You know, I realized that as a physician, I take care of people who are worried all the time, and my role is to reassure them, to say, look, that's just an x-ray I'm doing. I'm not worried about the big C. Or, you know, people have their own personal terrorists. And I began to realize that on top of that, after September 11th, people were worried about things in the news and that it was a growing problem. So I said, well, wait a minute, is there any science behind this? And I found out that simultaneous to this going on, that there was a major thrust in neuroscience to find out about fear. So while people were becoming more afraid, neuroscientists were finding out why simultaneously. So therein lay the germ of a book. I also was interested in this from the point of view of religion, by the way, because religion is set up to calm our fears and to tell us we may be afraid of things like death, but we have, you know, the Almighty to protect us. But then I realized that these days, that isn't enough for many people. That isn't enough, and we just get radioactive with fear.
Yet prior to 9/11, they were still trying to create fear for us with big pharma, government, media, right?
Yes. You know, shark attacks or the media misdirects us. It tells us that things are going to get us that really aren't. It's part of selling a story. You know, it's always strangers that are going to get you in the news, because the news knows that strangers sell. In the meantime, crimes are usually committed by people you know. That's an age-old story, and that's gone on way before 9/11. But there were the killer bees, there was the Y2K, there were many, many scares. There was Columbine. There were many scares before 9/11. 9/11 ramped it all up, though.
What happened to the killer bees, by the way? Where'd they go?
I don't know. I think they got their honey and they went to sleep.
I mean, I thought they were going to get us all at one point.
Well, maybe they were in a worst case scenario, but as it is, I think they never made it out of the farm.
Let's go to the phones. So let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us with Dr. Mark Siegel. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you tonight?
Good. Thank you. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Salt Lake City. My name is Virginia.
Virginia, it's all yours. Go ahead.
Okay. And Dr. Siegel, I was wanted to ask you about statins in connection with triglycerides. Now, is that the kind of medication that a doctor would prescribe for triglycerides?
It is one of a few they would. It has a secondary effect on triglycerides. So it is... It is something that they look at. They have another alternative they can use for that. But if you have a high triglyceride, sometimes you have a high cholesterol at the same time, and that's a twofer drug. It'll get both. It'll knock down both.
Yeah, I've been told I have the high triglycerides, not high cholesterol.
Well, it's usually a first attempt is to use a statin drug for that.
Yeah. What kind of side effects do we have on these?
Well, George and I were talking about it before. Muscle aches are the main ones, and you know, people can get twinges or just a little bit of soreness that goes away. That's the most common thing. Some people have stomach upset with it, but not much. But beyond, and then you have to watch the liver. I mean, you got to have a doctor drawing blood every 4 or 5 months or so to follow your liver functions. But most people tolerate these drugs very well.
So, some doctors are prescribing with these statins now a supplement. Coenzyme Q10 or something like that? Is that what it's called?
Because there's some studies that show that really works very well at protecting the heart, the coenzyme Q10. But it's not as proven as, there's about 2 or 3 studies on that. It's not as proven, obviously, as the statins are. The statins are the first line of drug, but they have another set of drugs they use for triglycerides alone.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air. Hi there.
Morning.
Yeah.
My name's Bob. I'm calling from Minneapolis, and it's a lead. Your last question was a lead into mine. It concerns statins. I want to know. I've been on one since open heart surgery 8 years ago. I'm on the VA formulary, which is the simvastatin. I found out when I was exploring the over-the-counter variety, which comes from Chinese medicine. I think it's red rice yeast, and I was told that A, it is equivalent to Pravacol among the five or six statins. Bacol's, of course, in the tank. It has another unique property. It clears other than P450, so I can have grapefruit with it. But the serious thing that is current is the scare over H5N1, the flu. A very prominent epidemiologist, you may have heard of him, here in Minnesota, named Mike Osterholm, on national NPR the other day, was saying the last resort. Relenza is going to be in short supply. Tamiflu is being rationed now by Rush. You can't buy it. I have to get a statin. On the public radio, he said the last resort to stop what he refers to as the cytokine storm. To us laymen, it means drowning in your own phagocytes. Correct me if I'm wrong. But he said as an alternative to that, statins work. Now, could you just comment, a general professional comment on anti-inflammatories? Are all anti-inflammatories immune suppressive? And is it the immune suppressive nature of the statin which will serve as the last resort so we don't drown in our own phagocytes? Am I at all clear?
Yeah, you've gone over a few things at once. Just to put this in perspective, in terms of Dr. Osterholm, you know, he's an esteemed man and he has a lot of very smart things to say. I tend to think that on the bird flu situation, though he's extremely knowledgeable and in a world figure, I think he's tended to inflame the situation a bit by delivering a message that it's looming. It's not looming. There's nothing really imminent about it. It's a skill to say, look, we need to be better prepared for something that may come down the pike, that flu pandemics are inevitable and that we have to be better prepared. We don't have any hospital preparation. We don't have the right vaccines. That's different than saying something's going to happen this year. And in terms of the statin question, it is an anti-inflammatory effect, and that's why there's been some studies that seem to show it as a decrease of colon cancer and other cancers with it. But that's all just preliminary. And in terms of the yeast instead of it, you know, the only thing I have to say about herbs is that they are not well regulated. The nice thing about using a statin in a pill form is you know exactly how much of it you're getting. Red rice yeast is excellent stuff, but I wouldn't use it instead of a statin for somebody that's had a heart surgery. I definitely don't recommend that.
Would you use it in conjunction with?
Or
can you do too much?
You could do too much, and also... I probably would look to something like niacin first. The problem with niacin is it's very poorly tolerated, and red rice yeast is a little bit better tolerated. Niacin is a great low cholesterol lowering drug, but people don't tolerate it. They get very flushed.
Well, as a matter of fact, some doctors are now recommending you take an aspirin before you take niacin to fight the flush.
Yeah, that's right, but that doesn't work well either. And the niacin people came out with a new drug that supposedly doesn't cause the flush, but I think it does cause the flush.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good morning.
Hi. Go ahead,
good morning.
Sir.
Good morning, both of you. I was saying that I think people on the overall really enjoy being scared and afraid. You take the movie stars and the producers, they're all millionaires because the people go to the movies to watch monsters rip people apart or die of terrible diseases and stuff. So I think it's not so much that people are afraid, they enjoy it.
Well, you know, that's a great point to make, and it's funny that one of my favorite words with my fear book is the word voyeur, and I've almost got through the whole show tonight without bringing it up, and you reminded me of it. It is what we're doing. We're voyeurs, and if I could really convince myself that it's all in good fun, I probably wouldn't write the book. The fact is, I love a horror movie, and we've already said, George and I are both big fans of Hitchcock. I don't think anybody gets it better than him, and I love being scared, too, but the problem is that a lot of people are starting to believe these things, And if you believe it, then you don't turn the projector off, you don't turn the TV off, and what actually ends up happening is that you build up stress hormones in your blood that's bad for your health. It puts you at risk for things like heart disease and stroke and diabetes, and you can gain more weight, and smoking comes from this. So I'm concerned about the ill effects of fear. Fear is a thrill. You know, being scared is a thrill. I have no problem with that. And I also like the idea of fear being a warning system against imminent dangers. We shouldn't be using it to warn ourselves against things that are not out there.
I wonder, Mark, if people, some people are so afraid of things that they don't even leave their houses or apartments. I mean, they're locked in there, closeted every day. Do you think there are people like that?
There is such a phenomenon. It's called agoraphobia. And it's a social anxiety problem. But I actually heard that with this bird flu, you know, they're talking about you have to have a supply of food and water on hand. I mean, I'm telling you, this thing doesn't even affect humans yet. And one of my patients said he was going to have a gun. I mean, well, you know, what, this idea that you're not going to be able to trust your neighbor because he's going to be spreading flu to you, and there's going to be gangs, you know, a flu spreading people in the streets. I mean, you know, this is like your alien show, George. I'm telling you, it's science fiction here.
Absolutely. How can they create a vaccine, Mark, when they really haven't even found the mutation yet in order to create the vaccine? How can they do this?
Well, that's a good point. And, you know, the top health officials will answer it that way, too. If you ask them a direct question, you know, how do we know this vaccine is going to work after if and when this bird flu mutates? And the answer is they don't know. They think it would still have some effect, and they're probably right about that. You target these antigens, and even if it changes and there's antigenic drift or shift, they call it, you still get some effect. So the vaccine will work somewhat. But, you know, we don't have any idea that this virus is going to mutate into a form that can pass human to human. And if it did, it could be very mild or not come to kill any of us. So we're making a lot of suppositions. And the reason that this is all snowballed is because public health officials want you and me to know that avian flu itself is a bad thing, potentially. But they've targeted this one virus, and it's really gotten out of control.
What's going to happen next year or the year after? I mean, how many of these things can they come up with?
Well, there you go. I mean, we're talking the boy who cried wolf, right? I mean, if you
Yeah, I mean, SARS, nobody even talks about that. You brought up SARS. I talked about it a couple weeks ago as a where did it go. Nobody has talked about it.
Well, because the truth is that SARS turned out to be not as infectious as we thought, and it just went away and didn't come back. But again, there should have been some reckoning with that, to say, well, look, we were worried because it could have been bad, but it didn't happen. And the same people that were scaring us about SARS are up there scaring us now.
Years ago, I'm a reporter and a producer in Detroit, and we had several people die in a hospital, I think it was a VA hospital, of what they called Legionnaires' disease. And every once in a while, you'll have an outbreak where some people will die, a handful of people will die because of Legionnaires' disease. And that was supposed to be, back in the 70s, another panic for people. And though that is something that is out there, you're not talking about thousands of millions of people dying from it.
Because the reason is because when these things come about, they're really new and they're really sexy, and people, you know, get constantly jump to the worst case scenario right off the bat. They don't take things into account. Like Legionnaires' disease requires actually a certain kind of ventilation system, like you have on a plane. You could spread it, or in a wet area with a ventilation system. But it's not a bug that could become widespread. The same is true with West Nile virus. We were very scared about that, but people can't transmit that human to human. I like to say the fear of West Nile virus or the fear of anthrax is contagious, but not actually the bug.
Let's go first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Yeah, this is Donnie from Charlotte.
Oh, hi, Donnie. Go ahead.
Hi, Donnie.
Hey, I was watching the James Bond movie last week, whatever. It's about the one about the media that guy that mogul that's one, you know.
Oh, I saw that. It was on Spike TV.
Yeah,
I saw that.
And this is what gets me is the media is so powerful. It seemed like they could be held accountable for the scare factor or the, you know, somebody else, because, you know, like you said, you know, they don't even know if they can do anything to humans, but they got everybody all pumped up and freaked out. probably people stressing out and dying from stress and whatever, and, you know, they're not held accountable for, you know, they're given misinformation or disinformation. And it just blows my mind that we don't have any recourse for them to be liable for, you know, what they say over the news media, like CNN or MSNBC.
Well, what they do, Donnie, and then, of course, that James Bond movie had to do with a media mogul, Mark, who would go out and create the event, the terrorist event or whatever, and make sure his crews were there filming and videotaping it, and then he'd put it on his network shows. You know, he was just a wacko. But in this particular case, the media isn't generally creating the story. They're finding the experts to react to the story.
That's it.
And they can get away with that.
You know, and that's it. And the experts are all too willing to do that. And I like to say this is in my book. I like to say that that scientists should stick in the laboratory, not on the news conference. The problem is that somebody that has been spending their whole life looking over a microscope or looking over a test tube gets very excited about their virus, and they think it's the whole picture. Put them on TV for 3 minutes, and they're going to make you think it's the whole picture. And the media, you know, in that sense, it's not really the media's fault. The media just, they don't know how to gauge a story like this. They ask the experts, and the experts are telling them this is something to worry about. But the experts don't know how to use the language properly to put things in perspective. So it ends up snowballing. And then the media, you know, as this gentleman is pointing out, is not accountable at the other end. And that's the thing that disturbs me. And part of that is because with cable TV and the Internet is the biggest part of the problem. The Internet just broadcasts everything a million different ways. And you, by the time you're done, it's been distorted in all kinds of ways. And it's not even what it started out being.
I'm a health fanatic, Mark. So, you know, I've got a general doctor in Los Angeles and in St. Louis, the two cities I live in. And so I figure, you know what, whenever I want to, you know, I read up and I, you know, do, and, you know, when I have guests on the show who come on and say, you know what, you need chelation therapy, I jump into that. But one of the things I do with the Internet is if, you know, you go and get a blood test, you don't know what the heck those readings are, and the doctor tries to explain it in his medical way. But at least with the Internet, you're able to go on and look like at your blood profile and your chemistry, and it tells you exactly what all that stuff means. In that case, it's been very helpful.
And it's good. The Internet is very good for background information as long as you have, because you said at the beginning of the program, how do you treat this fear? As long as you have a guide, somebody to help you. My patients all come to me with Internet information, and I help them put it in perspective, because you talk about those blood tests. Some of the things when they're abnormal matter, and some of them don't, and it's hard to know which is which unless you've been reading blood tests for many years.
Absolutely.
The Internet will give you all the background knowledge. It's really, really good for that.
Do you sometimes get frustrated with patients who bring in Internet things, whether it's printed or otherwise, and they tell you about all these things?
You know something, George, I hope the answer to that is no, because the truth is that I try to understand as much as I can that what being a patient is about is being vulnerable. It's scary. I mean, that's what's scary. You know, when you're sick or you're afraid of being sick, you need somebody to comfort you and to not be insensitive. And of course, people that are faced with illness want to find out as much information as they can about it. So I don't have a problem. I'm not irritated by the Internet when it comes to, because there's some pure information you can get on the Internet. My issue is more with these ads, you know, the ads that tell you why you should use a medication.
Oh, absolutely. Good point. Stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls this Sunday and the Monday morning right here at Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Well, Matt Drudge is reporting on his website, drudgereport.com. Exactly what we were talking about in our first hour, that Iran is 4 months away from developing a nuclear weapon, quoting some United Nations sources. So get ready for the fireworks on this particular case. Children's International, by the way, wanted to mention that what a great way for this Christmas season to give a holiday gift, sponsoring a child, giving them food, clothing, healthcare, education, and much more by only donating $18 a month to Children International. That's all you have to do. They'll do all the work. They'll do everything else. Call 1-800-869-9863 or go to the coasttocoastam.com website. On the left-hand side of the screen, take a look at the small yellow banner. You click that, takes you right to Children International. I've got a personal goal of 500 by Christmas time. They are happy with 300, so we need your help. Back in a moment. Welcome back to Coast, Dr. Mark Siegel, final segment with your calls. Mark, we're not going to change government. We're not going to change media. We're not going to change Big Pharma or others who create this sense of fear and urgency. So what do we do? How do we get to people to get them to change their mindset?
Well, first we have to change ourselves. I mean, as I'm going over in False Alarm, I mean, the first thing we have to do is figure out cures for our own fear. And I'm subtracting from that equation, George, the fact that some fear is it keeps us awake. I mean, I really do understand that point that we like to be jazzed up. But when it gets to the point where it's controlling us, then we have to do something about it. And, you know, if we stop voting for the fear mongers or buying products from the fear mongers or turning on, you know, to hear fear messages constantly, we have control over this. I think, you know, it's up to us. You know what? The public may like to be afraid, but I don't think people want to be afraid of the wrong thing. In your first hour, you're talking about Iran getting nuclear weapons. That's something to be afraid of. I mean, the bird flu, is you should be afraid of if you're a chicken right now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. To the phones we go. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George and Dr. Siegel. And George, hi. Thank you for getting me through many a night. Because I have one of those fears called post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Well, we will continue to get you through many a night, Christine.
Thank you very much. But, Dr. Siegel, my question for you, and may I please listen off the air, is this. I, for the last 5 years, have been feeling that the United States of America has been ruling the population by fear. And I would like to hear your comments about this.
Well, you know something? Since you're a survivor of post-traumatic stress syndrome, I think that you're very sensitive to that exact point because you're like scalded from what you've been through, and I think you're picking up on the right thing. I think there's no question that we've been ruled by fear in the sense that we are told that there's a danger out there that only our leaders can protect us from, and whether that danger is smallpox or bird flu or Iraq. Whatever it is, we're not in a position to decide whether it's really true or not. I mean, you know what? The terrorists are a threat to us, and that's what set the model. I mean, let's face it, the terrorists are a threat to us, but the message that we're blurring is just how much of a personal threat they are to each and every one of us. They're a bigger threat to our psyche than anything else. And so I think we need more reassurance in some of the message we're getting. I agree with you that we can't be made to be afraid constantly because it's bad for us, and I think we are being controlled by that fear and paralyzed. And after all, we're a nation built on courage. Our symbol is the bald eagle. That's where we have to get back.
Absolutely. Wildcard line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir. It's all you. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, cool. Hey. Well, I was calling to ask why, because I remember you doing a show a couple months ago about the Marburg virus and about how dangerous that was and about how they cordoned off people and told people not to talk to people or even shake hands or anything. And that had such real effects of you know, actual people dying from it. Why did they pick something that really had no proof and no, I mean, I just, why, I mean, how do they, how are they selective on these type of ailments?
How do they do that, Mark? I mean, here we are. We have, you know, Marburg, Ebola. When it happens primarily in Africa, it's serious and it does kill people when they get in contact with those who have it. But in this particular case, how did this get blown out of proportion?
You know, he's asking a great question. It has to do with mixing up potential from what is actually impending. Something like Marburg virus or Ebola are viruses that do very bad things to people when they get them. We see these terrible pictures, and we start to get afraid. So it's a sinister thing that scares us rather than, you know, the thing that is most out there getting us, like tuberculosis or malaria. I mean, malaria doesn't scare us because it's just a mosquito and because it's so far away. But something like Marburg virus is this terrible overnight killer, so we suddenly get voyeuristic about it, think it's going to happen to us. Now, to be totally fair to that, I want to back off and contradict myself a little bit. At the very beginning, when something is an emerging disease, we really don't know. So that can explain also why something like that, you know, is so scary to people at the beginning. Once it's tracked itself, it kind of declares itself. You know, Ebola scared us more at the beginning. Now we know that Ebola really isn't getting out of control. So it's a potential, but I think we overdo it. I think we inflame things way too much. And, you know, I mean, look, it's, not everybody is an infectious disease expert, so you can easily get scared about something you don't know anything about.
What are the possibilities that this avian flu was concocted in a laboratory and got loose?
No, that's not the case. But the trouble is, George, that can happen with a similar virus. I mean,
True. That's
a real scary idea. Somebody actually published the 1918 virus on the web. I mean, you know, that's just sin there. I mean, it's really absurd. That's actually a big downside to the internet. We're talking about the upside, but the downside is there's some very nasty stuff you can get on the internet. And there's no question that somebody could genetically engineer a very bad bug. It just hasn't happened. That's H5N1 appeared naturally in nature. It's been around for a couple of decades, actually, but on its own it mutated around the 1990s. But you know what? It hasn't really changed much since 1997, which is why several infectious disease experts who are not being heard, I think, are saying maybe it won't change and will stay in birds.
Let's go to the east of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
This is Caleb calling from Topeka.
Sure.
Just wanted to say thanks, George, for putting on such great shows.
You are welcome.
Quick comment before I get into my question. Talking about fear and terrorism and all, and I just think that the government's probably some of the bigger terrorists out there than what they're telling us about, because they're controlling us with fear. But my question for the doctor is, what kind of research is there for, say, cancer cures or prevention?
Well, you mean, that's a broad question. I mean, I think there's a lot going on with cancer right now, but the trouble is, like on the negative side with fear, we get overly afraid of a bad virus. On the thing with cancer is we get optimistic a lot about things, and we got to admit that Western medicine, I mean, it's really just a primitive notion of how to treat cancer. You basically poison the tumor and you poison the body, and you hope you poison the tumor more. But to be fair, they're using antibodies now to track cancer, and I think that they've made a lot of strides in the past 5-10 years about treating certain types of cancer. What's going to happen, and the future of cancer treatment has got to be in genetic engineering, where they figure out what makes somebody susceptible to a cancer, what's the genetic issue, and how to correct it with gene modulation. That's where it's going to go. But they've been talking about that for about 5 years already, and it really hasn't happened yet.
For more than 30 years, God love him, Jerry Lewis has been trying to raise money for muscular dystrophy. I'm sure he's raised over hundreds of millions of dollars by now. Yet, over all these years, Mark, still no cure. Why? Is it a waste of money when you do things like that? Or, you know, do some of these, research agencies that are working on trying to find cures really don't want the cure, they just want the funding in order to just keep working? Is that possible?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Jerry Lewis is just an unbelievable prince with that, and he's very personally involved. I know this because I do a lot of work at Rusk, the Rehabilitation Institute in New York, and he's very closely tied in with them, and he's just amazing. But I already answered my question halfway. I gave away my answer, George, because really a lot of the money for muscular dystrophy goes into actually learning new techniques of rehabilitating people, and they've done a really good job with that. So I don't think the money's wasted on that level, but the problem is it's a very puzzling disease, and they really haven't made much strides in terms of figuring out, because there's several different varieties of it, and they don't really understand how it happens or what to do to prevent it from happening. But, you know, every now and then a disease comes along where you're saying that, and that suddenly changes, like Gaucher's disease. I mean, they come up with an enzyme. I don't think the money is wasted at all, because it's shown, it's put a lot of attention on that disease and on how to rehabilitate it, which has come a long way.
Yet, though, I mean, my point is are there some people within any organization that would rather continue to get funding every year than to find the actual cure? And I mean, and that's,
yeah,
you know, that's
it makes it easy for them because the money's pouring in. There's no question.
Exactly. I mean, and that's a tough question to ask anybody. But, you know, if there's a cure, then there's no need for funding anymore, right?
Right, and you know, the people know how to write grants, and they know how to write requests for money that sound better than they really are, and that, you know, a lot of people getting fat out there off of research that's not going anywhere, and you know, that's a very unfortunate part of it.
Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast, you're up. Hi there.
Hi, this is Ray out of Yankton, South Dakota.
Hey, Ray, go
hey,
ahead,
Ray.
Sir.
Last January, I forgot to pay my cable bill, and a guy came out, and he shut my cable off, and I had this great sense of relief, you know, and I haven't ever gone back to TV since, and it just really cut a lot of stress out of my life, because, you know, these guys can't get to you anymore, you know, and it's not that I don't know what's going on in the world or anything, but, you know, I just get a little news at a time, not just lambasted 24 hours a day.
You know, I think that's right, Ray. You know, I have a funny part of that in my book that I keep forgetting to mention, which is I studied the blackout in the Northeast in 2003, and I actually wondered why people were so calm. People were, you know, were sharing food. They were talking to their doormen here in New York. There was a lot of nobody panicked during that blackout. I came to the conclusion it's because the cable news was shut off. The TVs were dark. You know, and so I think people have to learn a skill of how to approach the TV with a grain of salt, because after all, it's a form of entertainment. And I'm not against cable news. I just think that I participate in cable news, but I think that there's got to be a way not to obsess on it. And I'm not surprised that you haven't missed it.
Okay, next up, only a few more minutes to go. First time caller line, your turn. Hi.
Hi, this is Lisa Collins from Maui.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Dr. Siegel and George Norrie. My question is I've been trying to wean myself off of Atenolol. It's a high blood pressure medication.
Yes.
And I read someplace in the health food store, I can't remember which book, and it said that if you take Atenolol, don't take licorice. And I love licorice, and what I'm figuring out is, I not the licorice that you get that's got the sugar in it, but I buy the root and I chew on it, and then I have like two or maybe three cups of tea a day. And I'm finding I'm getting relief from that. I don't take high blood pressure medicine for high blood pressure. I take it because I get migraines, and it helps the oxygen blood get to the brain. I just wondered if you knew of that.
Yeah, well, okay. First of all, I would say that I'll say the obvious. If you're going to taper off Atenolol, which is a beta blocker, it's known as a beta blocker, and I understand it can prevent and be a preventative for migraines. It's got to be tapered over at least a week, and you should do it in conjunction with a physician. You shouldn't really do it on your own.
Yeah, that's what my doctor said also.
Yeah, and that's standard. In terms of the licorice, you're asking a very smart question there. There's a form of black licorice that has aldactone in it, which is basically something that can augment your blood pressure and can affect your blood pressure, but it's not directly. It's only certain kinds of licorice that has this, and it's not directly a problem with the Atenolol. So I wouldn't say that, but you can go ahead and have your licorice. Just ask before you purchase it. Does it have a certain ingredient that affects potassium? That's true in some of them, but not all of them.
Oh, okay. Because I just drink the tea and the root. I don't.
You can have it. You have your licorice.
Okay, thank you. And another thing I just want to mention, your former caller was saying fear. And we have a T-shirt over here that people wear, and it says false evidence appearing real.
Yeah, that's right.
I'd share that.
That's exact. False evidence appearing real or false evidence assumed risk, right? I'd like to get one of those T-shirts. That's great.
Next up, East of the Rockies. It's your turn. Hi there.
Yeah, so Rex in New Orleans.
Hi, Rex.
One of the reasons I think that that government officials tend to oversimplify things is I think the general public is basic. I've always said for years that the problem is we've got a toggle switch mentality versus a rheostat mentality. For us, things are either on or off. It's either a problem or it isn't a problem. We don't handle shades of gray very well. And so I think that the problem lies not with our leadership so much, but they're just responding to the way the American people respond to situations.
You know, that's a very interesting question that I've never really considered. Let's just say that I've heard people say, this goes along with that point, that people get used to something after a while. In other words, you blast somebody with some overblown fear, and then over time, it gets assimilated. Of course, that's not how I would like to go about doing informing the public. But if the public is like that, you know, kind of a toggle switch, I think that means learning a new set of skills, because when things get oversimplified in a very complex time to live, there's no reality. I mean, this is a very complex time. Things are not yes or no, black or white, on or off. And you get in trouble with that message, sure.
Final phone call. West of the Rockies, or Wild Card Line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Beth. I'm calling from Tennessee.
I just have
a quick comment. I teach my children and have been teaching them for years when it comes to fire safety, safety about strangers, and so forth. Just a simple little motto, don't be scared, be prepared.
That's a beautiful statement, and, you know, I'm glad you're the last caller because I almost didn't get to the most important thing of all. I have three kids myself. They're all young, and it's very important that you not be afraid yourself, because otherwise your kids will be afraid. Kids look for you for strength, not fear. I mean, you want to know the main reason that I have an anti-fear message? Because I want my kids to not be afraid of things that don't threaten them.
Well, and we need to teach them that, because they're going
to be
faced with it every day.
They're bombarded with it in the news. They hear about it before you do. You think kids don't know. I mean, they hear about it in camp. They hear about it in school. My son came to me the other day and said, Dad, I saw a dead pigeon. I mean, he was thinking bird flu. I said, no, I explained to him that birds actually die.
Well, I'm telling you, the next couple of years are going to be pretty fascinating, Mark. It'll be a roller coaster ride, I'm sure, but we'll all be there. And I appreciate you being on the program.
George, I loved it. I really enjoyed it. I'm happy to come back anytime.
Absolutely. It's called False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear, and it's a very, very good book. Thanks again, Mark. Appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you, George. Good night.
That's Mark Siegel. Okay, now for, of course, the team, Kiris Coburn, Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll get the week rolling. I'll be back with our next program in just a few hours, I guess, because the clock ticks when you do Sunday. Until then, be safe, everyone.